Durga rose shakily from cover. His gun was empty, its slide locked back. Bullets had lacerated his shoulder. Lakesh struggled to his feet, only able to use one arm to assist his efforts to stand.
Mo!
He trotted down the stairs to join Domi. Domi's anger was gone, replaced with concern as she saw Lakesh's arm and face soaked with blood. The scientist realized that he must have looked as frightening as she did. He dismissed the thought as she wrapped her arms around him, burying her face in his chest.
Domi!
You saved us! Those maniacs could have killed all of us!
The Queen was shot.
Mother?
I tried. I failed.
The prince's eyes grew pained as he looked down on the bullet-ravaged corpse. For all the suspicions that Lakesh had possessed about the Naga prince, he knew the cold truth that no son should have to see a parent violated by the horrors of gunfire. First Garuda, now Yun. Though the losses were separated by decades, Lakesh could see that Durga was hit hard by the grisly demise of the queen. He almost felt ashamed that he was going to present the evidence that the prince was behind both the impending threat of the Millennial Consortium and that he had been the force that organized the Fist of Enlil. Lakesh tried to wrestle his shame aside, but the heartbreak in Durga's eyes was hard to beat.
Are you okay?
Lakesh looked down at her. Her ruby-red irises were matched by the swollen, tear-irritated veins of the whites of her eyes. Tears left her cheeks glistening.
My arm hurts.
You have to say something about Durga.
His mother was just assassinated.
The furrows cut in his forearm and bicep were reminders of his failure to protect the queen. Domi pulled reluctantly away from him and faced the council.
The prince and Colonel Hedin worked together on this attack. The queen sent me to bring Hedin before this council.
Shell-shocked, confused citizens looked at Domi.
You ghouls! You're accusing me?
Durga trembled with rage and Domi tensed. Lakesh felt a twinge of panic in his heart, seeing Domi put aside the vulnerable, compassionate child and allow the cold fury to return.
It's true. The queen left these orders with me. We were called to respond to an attack by the humans of the Millennial Consortium. Already, Kane, Bridget, and Grant are out trying to hamper the Consortium's army. But we, as a council, have to agree to mobilize our forces.
Durga glared at General Chimera, then glanced back to Lakesh and Domi. Lakesh had cast aside his fear, standing as backup to his diminutive lover.
You hear this kind of paranoid ranting? My mother is lying in a pool of her own blood, and they want me arrested! They want a control to throw the lives of our soldiers away in an attack on a human army!
Come off it! If Hedin can't confess, I'm sure he left behind enough notes to prove your ass is guilty! Quiet!
All eyes turned to Hana as she stood over the limp, legless form of Manticore. The smoking gun in her hand became less the focus of attention than her hard, angry eyes that burned with seething fury.
The queen has been murdered, and her son is guilty!
She looked toward Manticore, the harsh rage flickering, replaced by a moment of hollow-souled sadness. Returning her attention to Durga, she aimed Manticore's pistol at the prince.
As the next in line of leadership, I demand justice. Destroy the Consortium's army, hang Durga and his conspirators, and the failures from Cerberus will be made to pay for their fumbling ways.
Durga, Lakesh, and Domi all shared a frightened moment as the beautiful, vicious princess's compassion shattered like glass, leaving behind a gaping hole where reason once ruled. Kane had sneaked within 50 yards of the ammunition stockpiles for one of the consortium's artillery nests. A quartet of mortar tubes was aimed toward the Naga hangars in the distance, stacks of fat shells resting in crates. The ex-magistrate was aware that the Millennialists could pump out those high-explosive rounds at the rate of 5 per minute per tube. While the combined total of 20 shells in a minute from one firebase didn't sound like much, each of the deadly mortar projectiles packed a pound of high-explosives. With the added firepower of the other two artillery nests, the 81mm and 120mm tubes had the power to carve a swath of destruction through even the heavily armored panels that protected the hangar. Given the number of crates of ammunition, this particular firebase had the potential to sustain its rate of fire for close to half an hour. It wouldn't require more than 30 seconds to hammer the hangar entrances open with the rain of thunder. The remaining ammunition would target the depths of the hangar and alternate exits from the Naga stronghold. With almost all exits to the outside world hammered shut by a wave of thunderbolts, the Cobra folk wouldn't be able to fight back while hundreds of savage pirates, bandits, and mercenaries poured into their midst. Kane also realized the purpose of the salvaged, refitted skimmers. The small flying saucers were able to slip through the wreckage of the hangars, able to hover within the confines of the building, providing vital air support. He'd seen and reported to Bridget and Grant the presence of a second skimmer. This particular craft's armament was highly visible, the long barrels of 50-caliber machine guns bristling through a jury-rigged gunport. The Twin 50 was a menacing piece of ordnance that could chew through stone walls and armor plate as if they were soft clay. Against snake soldiers defending their home, the dual-mounted machine guns would be like a scythe to grain. Naga bloodshed would be horrendous if they couldn't find a way to eliminate the skimmers. Kane keyed his contact.
Grant, when you bait your trap, I'll take up the slack on the second skimmer.
That's if the consortium's pilots are stupid enough to commit both of their skimmers to chasing my ass down. Besides, the range on those 50s is measured in miles, well out of reach of our puny little grenade launchers.
Puny? Grenade launchers?
Only 300 yards. Even without the beam weaponry of a normal skimmer, the pilots could hang half a mile up laughing at us as they poured bullets down like rain.
If they're both armed with 50s. We didn't see any guns on the first consortium skimmer.
Friend Hanna, please. We did our best to save the Queen.
Lakesh, what's wrong?
Punishing us for her death won't bring the Queen back.
Lakesh was obviously transmitting to Kane and the others without the knowledge of the Naga.
Hanna, I thought that Durga was the big plotter here.
Please, perhaps we can provide assistance to Manticore.
Manticore's down, and we can tell that Hanna had affection for him. Her pain must have driven her to distraction.
Distraction? The snake bitch probably has Lakesh shitting in his pants and has the backing of the Naga Council to lynch him. That's not distraction. She's bug-fucking-nuts.
Grant, why can't these things ever go simply?
Look out! Durga's getting away!
Fuck! Did they just kill him?
You let Durga slip away, but you assholes can punch a peaceful, wounded scientist! You dropped your contact, Mo.
Domi had taken over the running commentary to keep him and the others informed of their situation. At least Lakesh and Domi were on the same page with that strategy and were resourceful enough to transmit their signals.
So what do we do now? Maybe the consortium's attack would give us the chance to get Domi and Lakesh back.
If Hanna and the Naga weren't essentially good folk put into a shitty situation, I'd say let the damn snake squirm. Lakesh and Domi are family, even if Lakesh and I don't particularly act like friends. But if we let the consortium go through with its assault, innocent people are going to die, and that's not how we work.
Shit can't ever be black and white.
Baptiste, if you have your shot, you'd better take it. On three.
Kane tensed, finger poised over the trigger of his grenade launcher.
Baptiste?
Kane!
Shit! Light it up, Kane!
Things were going to hell in a handbasket. Kane aimed the launcher on the end of his copperhead. Then the ex-magistrate sliced through the forest, praying that he wasn't too late for Bridget's sake. The millennialist spread his arms wide as he sought to capture Bridget in a bear hug. But the smelly, bearded man with the scars on his face caught the heel of Bridget's palm in the nose. Blood gushed from Nguyen's nostrils. Stunned but not deterred, the Vietnamese pirate lunged again, this time lashing out with a hard fist. Bridget sidestepped the punch, winding her arm around Nguyen's extended limb. She turned, using Nguyen's weight against him.
So much for the quiet way.
She whirled to see a fading pillar of fire roll skyward, the flames dying out as they ran out of fuel to burn. Kane had already taken out one artillery site. Bridget was running behind the curve, and she scurried to the top of the rise, retrieving the copperhead that had been knocked from her hands in Nguyen's attack. Her time to take out the second artillery site was running down, and she shouldered the copperhead. The extra weight of the rifle grenade had thrown off the submachine gun's balance, and she adjusted her aim so that the shoulder-fired bomb would reach the ammunition stockpile, not fall short. As the explosive arced toward the emplaced mortars, she saw the movement of men in the long grass and between tree trunks, thanks to her multi-optic visor's night vision. Bridget adjusted her aim, leveling the copperhead at the advancing consortium mercenaries, when her grenade dropped in among the mortar shells. A heartbeat later, a rush of air hit the former archivist like a predatory cat. Flattened in the dirt, she saw flaming limbs and torsos tumbling in the air overhead. She realized that it had to have been the hired pirates who were manning the artillery site, their bodies torn asunder by proximity to the earth-shaking detonation. She blinked as the world returned to darkness. Bridget struggled to sit up, stunned by the force of the massive explosion. She got to her feet and discovered that the concussion force had torn the copperhead from her hands. She looked frantically around for it, knowing she didn't have more than a few moments to find it. If she couldn't get it, then she'd have to rely on her 9mm pistol.
Lose something, bitch?
Nguyen aimed the fallen copperhead as Bridget dived sideways. She was thankful for the ballistic protection properties of the shadow suit, but knew that if she hadn't leaped for cover, the angle of attack on the copperhead's rounds would have been sufficient to penetrate the high-tech protective polymers. Running in the thick brush, Bridget ripped her pistol out of its holster. The weapon gave Bridget something to focus on.
Bitch! I'll get you!
She wasn't hitting anything, but she was keeping the millennialist from transferring to another weapon and continuing his attempt to murder her. She just hoped that her adversary didn't have anything heavier than a pistol of his own. Bridget's most powerful weapon, her mind, recognized the sound of a grenade landing. With a lunge, she tumbled down the grassy slope where she'd thrown her attacker. Her butt and legs had been peppered with the splinters of wire and grenade shell, her boots too thick to be penetrated by the decelerating fragments. Nguyen scowled from his vantage point halfway up the slope, but Bridget had landed right in his line of sight. The Vietnamese pirate's handgun was a beast of a weapon that would probably knock a hole in Kane's old magistrate armor, let alone her sleek shadow suit. She aimed uphill at Nguyen. In her dive to escape the grenade, the pistol had been bound up with long, tough grasses and clogged with mud.
Jam?
Go ahead and gloat!
I will.
A bolt of black lunged into view, heaving Nguyen into the air. A bloody point of steel jutted through the pirate's chest, and finally the grim wraith behind him was recognizable. Kane hurled the corpse aside, the throw wrenching his blade out of the corpse's back.
No more gloating for you, asshole.
Kane slid down the slope in a controlled skid, stopping to scoop up Bridget's fallen copperhead. At the bottom, he extended a hand to Bridget to help her up.
Kane, Bridget, I'm pinned down by a patrol near my target.
Grant, we're on our way.
Durga never loved Hannah more in his life, and if he weren't fleeing to ensure his freedom, he'd have gone back and kissed her hard. As it was, he was positive that the next time she saw him, she'd do her best to drop all the fires of hell on him. Manticore looked in a bad way, and there was never any doubt about Hannah's affection for Maitre Nguyen. In response, the princess had snapped in an emotional burnout of epic proportions. Hannah's rage, directed at Lakesh, gave Durga the sliver of opportunity to escape. He squirmed out of the utility tunnel access hatch. A wave of nausea rocked him, and he tried to forget the horror of seeing his own mother's body torn apart, her blood staining the architecture. He remembered Enlil's taunting nightmare of watching Yun and Hannah pinioned on giant skewers. Before the telepathic conversation with the Anunnaki overlord, he had glossed over the end of their existence in his plotting. Yun would have died of old age eventually. As for Hannah, maybe he could have ultimately persuaded her to see things his way, to accept that a strong Naga nation needed to be forged by the fires of conflict with the two races most determined to render the Cobra folk extinct, human and Anunnaki. A cleansing war would safeguard the Naga from further reprisals, and maybe, down the line, coexistence with the mammals could be reestablished. There were hints that Hannah was starting to come around. Her rage at the failure of Lakesh and Domi to stop the death of the Queen was deep and genuine, a driving force that Durga had merely attempted to duplicate in the wake of his own assassination of Garuda. Maybe by the end of the day, Durga would have the opportunity to mend bridges with her. He'd grant her exalted standing in the new Naga Order, and even be so magnanimous that when he promoted her to second in command, he'd do everything in his power to return Manticore's legs, either through cybernetics or a reprogramming of the Cobra Baths to allow cellular regeneration. It had been one of his dreams to utilize the nanomachine technology to do far more than turn humans into cobra beings. He wouldn't have resurrected Garuda, but the idea of being able to restore brave minions to full health, despite horrific injuries, would have the dual effect of increasing his people's affection for him and keeping his army of magnificent warriors in peak condition. Durga paused in a corridor, tempted to either return to his own office, where he would be surrounded by loyal guards, or to check on Hedin, his fellow conspirator. What Domi had said, however, left him with the belief that Hedin wouldn't be in any shape to assist, even if he could still breathe. Durga froze as he turned into the hallway leading to his office. Fargo stood in the middle of the corridor, his coiled whip in one hand, his fat revolver clenched in his other fist. The millennialist archaeologist had gone from bullied and harried innocent to ready for battle, a cruel smile carved into his face beneath hard, determined eyes.
What do you want?
The assistance of the Overlord who let us in the back door. The consortium could be good friends if you let him.
Durga flinched. If Lakesh and the others were aware of his betrayal of the Naga to the consortium, then Fargo was in on the trick.
Who would really believe that the consortium could be friends?
I did. Twice. Once when they recruited me, and then when I thought that I could redeem myself in their eyes.
So you're not exactly the best spokesman to recruit me. Right now, Cain is softening up your friends, and I'm certain you were supposed to engage in sabotage within this city.
I managed a few things, thanks to all the distraction you've been providing. The devices I've improvised can either assist you, or they could help the consortium.
But not Cain and the others.
Why should I help them? They've threatened me enough.
Which means when the Cerberus interlopers return, they'll want a piece of each of us. Preferably the hearts.
You join me, I join you, it really doesn't matter. I need help and so do you.
And you would have an ally against the consortium.
The Millennial Consortium is a franchise, not a monolithic force. The board of directors engage in intrigues against themselves. I've got sponsors who still love me.
Then why?
I just need to know if you still hold a grudge for, you know.
Fargo tapped his own eye with the handle of his whip. Durga walked past Fargo, grabbing him by the bicep to drag him along toward his personal command center.
Chatting in the open is not a good idea. As for my eye, I've got two, and I can still see out of both of them. No harm done.
The pair entered Durga's suite of offices. Naga soldiers loyal to the prince were scurrying around, setting up barricades to repel angry factions looking for revenge against their leader.
So, Fargo, it will be a challenge to keep everyone from jumping on your back. I mean, you've got a small army, but so do they. And they've got the Cerberus people on their side.
Durga headed directly to his office.
Propaganda is a powerful tool.
Propaganda? When you've been implicated in offing your own mother?
Durga went to his desk and typed into his personal computer. The prince pulled up a voice modulation program, then inserted a microphone into a USB port. He hooked the computer to his intercom and typed in a control function on the keyboard.
What's that?
Durga smiled at his new partner, then brought the microphone to his mouth.
This is Enki, your god. Return to you. Now, Fargo, listen.
This is Enki, your god. Return to you.
The Overlord's voice?
This is Enki, your god. Return to you.
The chatter and debate sparked by Hana's assumption of leadership following the assassination of Matron Yun had faded as the voice of an Anunnaki overlord filled the air.
My children, your greatest trial is at hand, as my brother's worshippers of the human race are striking at you from two angles. Only my council, children, can save you from extinction.
Domi looked up from securing Lakesh's bandaged arm in a sling, her stomach turning at the sound of Enki's speech.
Mo, does that mean we're as fucked as I think we are?
Lakesh glanced around the meeting room. Though pained and a little clammy from his flesh wounds and the beating he took from Hana, the discomfort faded somewhat as he analyzed the reactions of the Cobra folk.
Crudely put, beloved, but yes. If it's Enlil posing as his brother, or if it's some other ploy of Durga to save his skin, we're going to have an uphill battle. The society has already been fractured by the events of the past few days. With the reverence for their creator guiding their actions, we'll be dealing with religious fanaticism.
So, skeptics will be our buds. Never enough of them around to dispel a conspiracy theory.
Or to confirm it.
He looked toward Hana. Waves of doubt and confusion rippled through the assembled Naga as the princess tended to the badly wounded manticore. An asp bolt had shorn his legs off above the knee, but the intense heat of the energy had cauterized the stumps so that Manticore wasn't losing blood. As it was, the crippled bodyguard looked delirious. Though the cobra folk didn't sweat, the luster of his scales was dulled, and Manticore's jaw hung slackly. Hana, torn between Enki's speech and her wounded bodyguard, looked to be in enough doubt that Lakesh thought she'd be receptive to what he had to say. Her authority was their only hope to quell the confusion wrought by the return of an overlord. It would be a gamble, however. Blame for the death of the queen hung on Lakesh, despite his best efforts. The added injury of Manticore had strained Hana's compassion to the breaking point, so much so that she'd waved a gun in Lakesh's face, then struck him so hard it knocked off the external plate of his contact.
Domi, help me carry Manticore.
But you've only got one arm!
Lakesh looked at his wounded limb as it hung in the sling. Deep furrows where bullets had scored his forearm and bicep left it in paralyzing pain. And if he exerted too much strain on it, he was certain to bleed through the bandages. It was worth it, though, if he gave Cain and the others a safe haven when they returned from dealing with the Anunnaki.
I've got a healthy arm yet. Just help me.
Domi nodded, and the two people raced to the princess and her wounded protector. Lakesh hooked his uninjured arm under Manticore's, letting the crippled Naga's weight rest on his shoulders and legs. Domi's wiry, compact strength slipped under Manticore's other side. Hana's eyes were a turmoil of anger and hesitation. She kept her handgun aimed at the floor this time. Lakesh didn't want a repeat of the pistol whipping he'd received before.
What are you doing?
We're getting Manticore someplace comfortable so I can stabilize his condition. I'm not a doctor, but even I can tell that he's going into shock from the loss of his legs. He might not be losing blood, but the trauma of getting limbs burned off could be too much of a strain on him, no matter how conditioned he is. The fact that he's easily as strong as Grant is probably the only reason Manticore is still alive.
Manticore nodded groggily, a weak smile on his lips.
Exercise. Meditation.
Listen to his voice.
Vitamins.
He's not going to make it if you insist on reining in these people. He needs attention now.
They already forgot you. Enki, or whoever has their attention now, help us.
Citizens! Citizens, we cannot afford this distraction. The enemies are at our door.
Silence, blasphemer!
Hana lowered her gun, her gaze falling on Manticore as he hung between Domi and Lakesh.
Dearest Hana, please. Together we can restore sanity, but his life is at stake.
Hana whirled in frustration, tossing aside a chair that was between Manticore and the door.
Damn you worms! Let the wounded through!
Several Naga moved out of their path as she led the way to the door. Snake men and cobra women looked at the princess with widened eyes. Her seething rage was an emotional whip, scattering them so that Lakesh and Domi could carry Manticore out of the abattoir. Lakesh grimaced, not because of the weight of his wounded ally, but because he recognized the angered impatience, the same dialogue the Durga had used about the rest of the Naga. Perhaps the princess had an opportunity to be pulled back from the abyss, but Lakesh worried if she should slip. He kept silent, carrying Manticore to safety. Grant lurched against the side of the tree trunk. The smoldering remains of the mortar tubes he'd blasted were lit from behind by burning grasses that also illuminated the men who hunted Grant. The ex-magistrate had purposely missed the ammunition stockpile with his initial shot. The artillery launchers would be hard to replace. He wanted to save the big blast for when the skimmers came in for the kill. Unfortunately, instead of the airborne ships, Grant was faced with dozens of gunmen who had scrambled to protect the last of their thunderous punch.
Grant, the skimmers are pulling to about a mile of altitude. We're not going to get a shot at them, but they'll be able to rain down on you.
Where are you, Cain?
A little bit above your position. Call it 50 yards.
I'm a few yards away from Cain. You left your intended target alone.
And the goons are staying far away from it. Our first two big hits taught them to avoid being caught in the blast radius.
Hang on. Domi, Lakesh, where the hell is the Naga Air Force?
The advisory council's too busy to authorize them to take action now.
Where's Lakesh, Domi?
Lakesh lost his contact when Hana smacked him one.
So what's the council busy with?
Someone who sounds like one of the snake faces just made an announcement over the intercom. Ugh. Sorry, Manticore.
What happened to him, Domi?
The insurgents blew off his legs. We're getting him someplace comfortable. He's in shock.
Who sounds like an Anunnaki?
Not sure. Might be Enlil, or it might just be Durga. Either way, people are getting religion around here. And not the turn-the-other-cheek style.
Who do you have on your side?
Hana's here.
Domi, ask her if any deathbirds are ready to go.
Doesn't matter. We've still got the skimmers in the air. They're too agile, even with the damage they've suffered. The guns the consortium put on them will just be too powerful.
The skimmers and their larger counterparts are controlled via a mental energy interface. Domi, ask Lakesh if he could try that. He says he'll do his best.
Tell Hana that we'll do what we can, but those skimmers are small enough to fly into the underground passages, and with the weaponry that the consortium's packed onto them, hundreds could die.
We're on our way to the hangar. Just hold out a little longer.
All right, we'll soon have air support.
Provided Lakesh doesn't get them all shot out of the sky.
Grant squinted, keeping watch to see if the mercenaries were aware of his presence.
Doesn't look like they've got a bead on my position.
The multi-optic band is showing me that they are passing you, but they don't seem to have noticed you.
Hold your spot, Grant. I've got a small patrol coming up on your right.
Grant scanned the forest, spotting a group that Kane had mentioned. They were being led by a squat, compact man in the gray coveralls of the consortium. He wielded a Coleco submachine pistol, and from his position in the group and the hand signals he communicated with, he was the leader of the hunt for the Cerberus trio.
Got him. Once this bunch passes, I'm going to take them from behind.
The rest of the group isn't coming toward us. You don't have to risk it.
You want to leave a bunch of thugs willing to work for the millennialists running around India? Besides, I've got a couple hundred rounds of artillery ammunition to blow the hell up.
I'm so glad he's on our side.
Grant smiled, slipping through the waist-high foliage to flank Devin Lan and his cadre of hired guns.
I'd say I aim to please, but I don't. I just shoot to kill.
Devin Lan grimaced at the thought of the three Cerberus interlopers, Kane, Grant, and Bridget Baptiste, interfering with his plans. He tried to dismiss the knowledge that he was here at the whim of the Millennial Consortium, and that he was subordinate to Christian, the ex-magistrate-turned-mercenary, but he couldn't. The war to cripple the Naga and to steal their secrets was his. He was the one who was taking the risks. He was the one who recruited most of these thugs, and he had literally organized this entire operation based on the information leaked to them by their Anunnaki benefactor. Lan was the man who set this up, no matter who pitched in to do the grunt work.
My freaking war. Where the heck is Nguyen?
We lost track of him, sir.
Guapo was a South American pirate who had been picked up on the Vietnamese coast. He shook his head, unable to believe that a warrior was so insecure in his own appearance that he had to censor himself with weak, half-baked versions of curse words, even at his most angry. It bespoke an intellectual dishonesty with his own emotional state and smacked of childishness.
Darn it, find that idiot!
A shadow suddenly loomed over Lan. Guapo swung up his SIG-AMT rifle, but Grant threw a rock. Lan froze in horror as he watched Guapo go limp on the ground. He tried to turn, but big, powerful arms wrapped around Lan, heaving him into the air.
You want to live, asshole. You better stay quiet.
Buzz off!
Grant's sinewy arms squeezed.
Did you want me to fuck off?
What do you want?
A shield for now.
The rest of Lan's unit wondered why two of their number had fallen behind. Then they saw their commander dangling like a rag doll in the embrace of the giant ex-magistrate.
Kill this freaker!
But Grant dragged him, legs kicking wildly, back toward the artillery nest. Suddenly, the pressure on his ribs disappeared, and he was sailing through the air toward a sack of sandbags. Lan struggled to get to his hands and feet. He wondered where his weapons went. He knew that he dropped the Coleco when Grant snatched him up like a toy. Unfortunately, when his numbed, oxygen-starved hands slapped at his holster, he found that his handgun was gone. Grant moved swiftly, turning the sole remaining mortar tube and aiming it at a 90-degree angle to its original arc of fire. Somewhere in Lan's mind, he realized that the big Cerberus fighter was turning the heavy weapon toward the consortium forces. Grant adjusted the base, popping in a second shell. A third mortar bomb was dropped into the muzzle.
Oh, oh, oh.
Lan blinked, trying to recover his senses. As the millennialist sat up groggily, unable to concentrate on any one physical task, his eyes wandered to the field beyond the sandbags. There, a tall, wolf-like man and a woman with hair the color of flame tore through the remains of his patrol unit. Lan counted a dozen bodies laid out by the two people who could only be Cain and Brigid Baptiste. He cast about, looking for a weapon of some kind. He then spotted a crowbar that had been used for popping the tops off ammunition crates. Lan turned in time to see the waffle tread of Grant's boot fill his vision. Cain and Brigid vaulted over the row of sandbags surrounding the wrecked mortars. Grant stepped back from kicking the consortium member in the face. The man was obviously a full recruit, as he wore the classic uniform of the millennialists and had a badge with the emblem of the organization.
Who was that?
Some fused-out moron with delusions of adequacy. He's out cold.
Merciful of you.
Grant had struck three of the projected camps, thanks to the coordinates given to him by Bry.
Merciful my ass. You just want him to tell the consortium who crippled their army. And they're not known for being nice enough to only shoot the messenger.
I take immense satisfaction knowing that the right people hate me. Looks like we've got the attention of the mercenaries, at least.
The salvo didn't bring in the skimmers, but Lockish might be able to take them out.
I'd rather he'd land and pick me up. Sure, those things might be operated by a telepathic interface, but my brain's wired for combat piloting. I'm not even sure Lockash has done anything on a computer flight simulator in fun.
We'll know soon enough. Look!
A silver bolt speared through the sky from the direction of the Naga's underground base. The three Cerberus warriors dialed their multi-optic visors, but tracking the speeding spacecraft as it sliced the air was difficult.
Lockash, slow down. You'll never be able to hit anything.
Slow down?
You got your comm working?
Domi let me use hers. She's back at the hangar helping out Manticore.
Well, ease up on the throttle.
What are you talking about?
Above them, lances of silvery fire emitted from the skimmer toward two objects in the night sky. Cain watched as the skimmer hovered for a moment, as if to gloat triumphantly over the blazing wreckage that spiraled toward the earth below.
Shit, that's not Lockish. It's undamaged.
Andwell? But...
The skimmer dropped rapidly, like a silver coin after a gentle toss. Shimmering beams of silvery light pulsed from the craft, punching into the ground with rapid, brutal efficiency. Cain grabbed Brigid.
Time to go.
The two people raced frantically out of the exposed artillery pit. Once Enlil was finished carving up the consortium forces, there was no doubt that the Overlord would want to take a few shots at his mortal enemies. Grant took a moment to heave the unconscious Lan out of the mortar pit. The stunned millennialist rolled down a slope, hopefully to a safe distance from the explosion Grant planned. Grant set the radio-controlled explosive charge in a full crate of 120mm warheads, then leaped away, hot on Cain's and Brigid's heels.
There's another skimmer, dear God!
Grant spotted Lakesh's ship in the distance, then looked back to see the Anunnaki-controlled craft hovering above the stockpile of ammunition they'd just evacuated.
Right time, wrong target.
Grant thumbed the remote on his charge. The explosion had been meant to pound the responding consortium forces into uselessness. Enlil's ship had taken care of the human army, but Grant's detonation still bought some time. The skimmer toppled end over end through the sky, its silvery sheen blackened by the touch of superheated flames. Cain and Brigid caught up with Grant, who pocketed his remote detonator.
The ship just looked knocked around.
Still knocked that asshole out of the air. If he wants to pay me back, he's gonna have to cut through some angry Naga to get to me.
Right. Lockish, you still there?
I'll be over you in a few moments, friend Cain. Anytime friend Grant wants to take over flying this consternating contraption, he's fully welcome.
Crippled an army, knock down a god, and get to try out a new ride. I guess the squeaky wheel does get the oil.
Cain looked toward the skies. He knew that a mere explosion, no matter how many bombs were in it, was never going to be enough to bring down Enlil. The emergency first aid station in the hangar was well-equipped as Domi tended to Manticore. She was able to set up an intravenous bag for the Serpent Man. Domi was thankful that the blood of the Naga was not drastically different from that of humans, and that a simple saline solution could be used to restore blood pressure. Over her shoulder, Hannah watched nervously as Domi administered a shot of morphine.
Will he be all right?
His heartbeat's returning to normal. The IV I gave him is already working.
No one has cared about me as much as he did.
He'll pull through.
He'll never walk again.
It doesn't matter.
It will to him. He was born to be a warrior.
One of the bravest warriors I ever knew was a champion even after his legs were cut off. He battled a terrible monster and gave his life.
Who was he?
A good man who called himself Zhu. He fought inside a suit of mechanical battle armor. And he was only one of many brave people who had lost their legs or suffered other horrible injuries. Their loss enabled them to pilot the machines they had found, however. They were able to fit into the warbots so that they could protect others.
An army of cripples.
He doesn't need a robot. He's earned a peaceful life.
But he'll condemn himself.
If he loves you, he'll hang on. He'll adapt. He'll change. He'll overcome. That's what Mo did.
Lakesh was rejuvenated by the power of Enlil.
And Bridget can figure out the cobra bats, if it's really that important.
I don't care. He's alive, and I'm not going to keep quiet about my love for him anymore. Oh, this denial.
That is going to be the thing that really keeps him alive.
Thank you.
A skimmer hovered in the hangar doors, and Domi pulled away from Hana, hand dropping to her pistol. When Domi saw the falsified scarring on its hull, she relaxed. She hadn't been able to hear the others because she had lent her undamaged comtac to Lakesh as he flew the ship out to assist Kane. Now they were back. When the boarding ramp touched the ground, Lakesh, Kane, and Bridget were the first ones off, running over to check on Hana and Manticore. Grant strode down the ramp, ducking his head so as not to bark it against the bottom of the skimmer. Domi rushed over to him, throwing her arms around his waist.
Domi, you're covered in blood.
I've been making myself useful.
Lakesh told me. Scared all the citizens, I hear.
Yeah, but sometimes you just have to kill a bunch of fused-out slaggers, right? Besides, I helped Manticore and gave Hana a little pep talk.
He doing any better?
Well, I've got an IV in his arm and painkillers. He's resting. Pulse is normal for a human. I had to check Hana's pulse to see if their hearts beat the same.
Smart girl.
Learning.
Enlil strode out of his skimmer, flanked by a half dozen Nephilim soldiers. His gaze scanned the horizon beyond the hammered section of forest that had been smashed by his toppling ship. Flaming sections of forest blazed, smearing the night's starry blue with choking black. The stench of roasted human flesh wafted through the air. Bodies had been blown to shreds by Kane and his allies in their effort to rout the Millennial Consortium's desperate bid to take over the war materials of the Naga. Enlil had engaged them as well, his brilliant mind commanding the skimmer's gunnery computers to engage any human that his ship's sensors could pick up. In a way, it was more satisfying than using the power he lost when Tiamat was destroyed. Down here, close to the battle, he could enjoy the carnage with satisfaction, eliminating the rebellious apes who wouldn't have developed without his guiding hand. The Naga, however, were an insult created by Enki. Enlil had crafted his Nephilim warriors before his brother crafted the Serpent People, but Enki, ever the soft heart, gave his creations autonomy. With the addition of free will, Enki's warriors were a fierce people, choosing their paths and able to adapt to unexpected situations. When Nephilim and Naga clashed, Enlil's warrior drones were exterminated. The thought of having an army of venom-fanged, highly trained warriors was attractive to Enlil. If he could convince them that he was their benefactor, then he could take the subterranean realm's forces and re-establish his unopposed mastery of the Earth. Without the Twa'ha de Danann to interfere, and with his brethren scattered across the globe, scrounging for their feeble stores of ancient treasure, Enlil would be a supreme force on the planet. He walked through the grass and stopped. A man lay in the mud before him, dressed in the clothing and wearing the symbol of the consortium. Enlil reached down and hauled Devon Land to his feet like a rag doll.
It was my attack.
I thought the commander of this operation was a magistrate named Christian.
He's a blowhard, a gun-obsessed, foul-mouthed fool. I did all the work. This was mine. I deserved all the credit.
Instead, you will receive all the blame, as the army you worked so hard to assemble has been crushed by three people.
Of course, I do the work, but someone undeserving is the credit for victory. I exist only in failure, and then I earn only derision.
No one respects a creative vision. No one except me.
My lord, give me a chance. I will storm the gates of hell unarmed if necessary.
Enlil smiled at him. He turned Lan gently around and accepted a nodule from one of his Nephilim. He inserted the node into the base of the human's neck. Cybernetic smart metal tendrils pierced his skin, connecting with his central nervous system. Ribbons of living alloy wrapped around Lan's limbs and torso, sealing him in flexible, bullet-resistant armor. Around his right forearm, three snake-like heads grew, their bulbous tips glowing with inner fire. Lan turned back, clad in his armor, then knelt before his lord.
What is your name, son?
Devon Lan, servant of Enlil.
Rise, Lan. We have places to go.
Where, sir?
To retrieve my brother's nanomachine that. I have an army that needs rebuilding, and hopefully I will add the Naga to that force. If not, perhaps you could recruit a new force. One which will be guided by your brilliant vision.
Yes, sir.
Enlil grinned and led the way through the forest toward the Naga's underworld lair. His army had already grown by one. Soon, it would become even greater. Manticore lay back in the dolly, boxes raising him to eye level as Grant wheeled him through the hallways. The morphine's slumber had not lasted long, his magnificent physical conditioning returning him to wakefulness. His mouth felt like cotton inside, and although he was awake, his faculties hadn't quite returned.
What's funny?
Manticore rolled his head back, looking at Grant out of the corner of his eye.
I am a cotton mouth steak. Snake.
Need something to drink? I'm just keeping your spirits up.
Both.
Grant dug into his war bag. He had a canteen inside, and he pulled it out.
Drink up.
Finished it. Sorry, Grant.
No worries. Hang on to the canteen, would you?
That'll work.
You'll be back in action soon enough.
That's what Dummy told Hannah. At least in my dream.
Nah, she really said that. Just hang in there.
For what? I'm being rolled around like a delivery package. It's not like I'll ever walk again.
So what?
So what? I have a duty. I'm her protector. What am I going to do, run someone over with my wheelchair?
Some of the toughest people I ever met were wheelchair-bound.
What, those Greeks with the robots?
Some of them. And for a while, Erica Van Sloan was in a chair. Didn't stop her from being a menace to us.
I don't know if it'll be the same.
Who cares? So you're not kicking people in the face. What matters is that Hannah isn't giving up on you. Did you get your dick shot off?
No.
Then I don't see a thing keeping you from her, especially now that we're going to hunt down Durga and kick his ass all the way to Calcutta.
I'm not royal blood.
You're a Naga. And what's more, you're a Naga with a sense of duty. What the hell is more worthy than that?
Point made, Grant. Point made.
Durga and Fargo were surrounded by a cordon of the prince's loyal guards, 30 strong, all of them armed with black assault rifles and strapped into Kevlar body armor that Durga had set aside for his warrior elite. It wouldn't protect the snake men from headshots, but as the battle in the council chambers had proved, scoring headshots in the midst of a blazing firefight was not going to be easy. The American-made M16s that Durga's personal elite carried were equipped with 40mm grenade launchers. For now, the Cobra bodyguards had tear gas, flashbang, and rubber baton rounds in the grenade launchers. The weaponry was for crowd control. The less than lethal options in the launchers meant to preserve as much of Durga's future constituency as possible. Durga needed new bodies in order to maintain his bid for power. Another of Durga's followers was back in the office with a page of script that the prince had prepared for him and had continued the speech in Enki's voice. The voice alteration module in Durga's computer rendered the new speaker indistinguishable from Durga's opening words, or from the original Enki, for that matter.
I particularly enjoyed the touch where Enki had been in telepathic contact with you.
I wouldn't have been able to come up with that had I not been playing Enlil like a fiddle.
You've been in contact with Enlil? And been manipulating him?
How do you think I captured a skimmer?
So, you've got the Consortium and Enlil working to take over the Naga. And did you intend to bring the Cerberus folk into this?
It was inevitable that they were going to be involved in our conflict, just by the very nature of their opposition to both of the parties I've been toying with. Letting you live and escape wasn't part of some overarching plan. I figured you had a few options open to you to get back into our city. One was sucking up to the Consortium, and the other was seeking refuge with the most powerful enemy of the Consortium. Either way, Kane and his companions were on the way.
You set up all of this based on a lot of unstable premises.
I've been plotting for 30 years to take control. It was getting to the point where I was going to set up my own variation of the Consortium to make its attack, which is why I ran so many expeditions into the human territories. Not all of my Naga warriors have bathed in the nanomachines. Many are Cobra at heart, and they have scoured the planet, keeping me informed of all that was necessary for me to advance my cause of forming a Naga crusade.
So when the stories of Kane and his outlanders rose, you began factoring it in. And when the Millennial Consortium made its presence known...
Precisely. Suddenly I had an overabundance of scapegoats with which to launch my crusade. I paused in my plotting and observed. When the Anunnaki awoke a while back, I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to conduct my plan. Instead, Lilitu's greed handed me another faction on a silver platter, destroying their central power base and scattering the overlords to the four winds.
30 years. Even longer. Garuda was said to have been killed by a helicopter's machine gun. But the weapon you manned on your jeep, it was in the same caliber, wasn't it?
Yes. Astute observation.
And you just killed your mother. Now it should be obvious that you gunned down your dad if you're ruthless enough to pull this off.
The group entered the hall of the Cobra Baths. Ancient mechanized pumps and glowing green liquid in transparent tanks lined the walls. In the center of the great chamber sat a coppery bowl-like pool 3 feet deep. Golden-colored pipes snaked from the tanks to the pool.
Would you like to take a dip?
You mean cast off this human shell and become a snake man?
Or you could maintain your current visage and be able to pass among the humans as my agent.
Fargo looked at the bowl. Durga tilted his head, noticing an unnatural focus in the man's eye. The archaeologist doffed his hat and crouched near the edge.
Baptiste said that there would be some form of control interface.
Correct. You see something?
It's what I don't see. No drain.
The nanite solution sucks back up through the pipes. Actually, the waters have always been observed to flow back into their tanks after they have initiated the change. I guess the miniature robots literally carry the suspension solution back with them as they climb out of the bowl. A matter of programming, perhaps?
Shovels and crowbars. Some of you carefully disconnect the pipes so we don't damage them. We need to lift this giant bowl out so we can get down there.
A chamber beneath this one? We'd always consider this to be the lowest portion of the Naga City.
Soldiers began dismantling the pipes around the bowl.
Right, but this place has been through a flood that killed thousands and destroyed or cut off sections of the city. The quakes caused by nuclear missile strikes on the mountain range above would have further isolated the sections beneath.
But we have the nuclear reactor packed a full mile beneath the city. That was set up in the second half of the 20th century.
The Indian government did all this digging and didn't discover you?
It was a mutual effort. Back in the time before Skydark, the Naga were still interacting with humanity, just on a clandestine level. We combined efforts to fortify a war base in this region in case Pakistan made an attempt to take back the Kashmir.
So, India kept you quiet as the ace on the line.
You noticed the disparity in architecture on the hangar levels. We simply pulled back to allow the humans to make use of those sections of our city. No unauthorized human ever saw a Naga. Just the evidence of an abandoned, damaged underground city.
It was never a matter of hating humans.
Without humans, I wouldn't be the heir apparent to the throne now. Yes, I called you hairless apes before, but it was an act. Some of my most loyal and capable followers are mammals.
Durga's soldiers hefted the bowl out of its slot in the floor. The depression in the floor had a hatch in the center, where a drain would have been had it been a standard pool. Fargo leaped down and looked at the locks holding it in place.
Durga, how knowledgeable are you about the pictogram language?
I've been studying it all of my life.
Good. You're more familiar with this, then. These locks look as if they have to be released in a certain pattern. If we get it wrong, then a booby trap may go off.
How bad would it be if we failed?
As bad as nanites programmed to turn our flesh into viscous paste. Or just poisonous gas. Either way, it wouldn't be the prettiest or most comfortable of deaths.
High explosives wouldn't clear the way past the latches?
Normally, with ancient societies, I would have said yes. But this was supposedly installed by Enki, and his enemies were his brother and the Tuatha De Danann. Seeing what the Nephilim's asp blasters can do, we have to open this the right way, or else we're going to be the most fucked humanoids on this planet.
Charming.
Of course, the safest way is to have someone else do it for us.
Durga pressed the earbud communicator he wore.
All units, report in. What is the progress of the Subrus expedition?
They open it up safely, fine. They open it and set off the trap, it's no skin off us.
I think this is the start of a beautiful friendship.
Wrong film.
Lakesh leaned against the wall, and Domi took a moment to wipe his sweaty brow with a rag. He smiled at her and stood back up, but she pushed him back to a leaning position.
You lost a lot of blood, Mo.
I'll be fine. Just some flesh wounds, really. No vital blood vessels were hit.
You got shot up enough to put your arm in a damn sling.
We have neither the time nor the materials to deal with this right now. Yes, I'm lightheaded, and my arm has been left incapacitated. However, I'd prefer to keep moving.
Grant slid Lakesh's arm out of the sling. Stripes of red showed through the bandages where rifle wounds had gouged his skin.
Grant, could you get Manticore and Lakesh back to our quarters? The rest of us will continue on.
That sounds like a good plan.
Why shouldn't I do it, Kane?
Because he could carry both of them at the same time if the shit hits the fan. You're strong, but you just don't have the acreage to run around with two fully grown men in your arms.
And we'll need the extra firepower if we come across Durga's people.
All right.
I'm sorry, friend Kane.
You damn near lost a limb trying to protect the Queen. And according to Manticore, you blew the head off one of the assassins, who outnumbered you 20-1.
I still failed.
Everyone does. Now stop beating yourself up. That's my job.
Let's go.
Grant wheeled Manticore's dolly once more.
Good luck. Get a spare contact plate out of our gear. This time we'll need your brains instead of your gun. A little saline solution to bring your blood pressure up to speed and you'll be able to hold your own, keeping the room secure. And just remember, you've been staying on your feet without painkillers.
I'm in no need of that reminder, friend Kane.
Lakesh moved to catch up with the Big X Magistrate. Kane turned back to catch Bridget smiling coyly at him.
You two have come a long way, Kane.
If Domi vouches for him, he can't be all bad.
Domi punched Kane in the bicep.
Lay off him! Come on, I caught a whiff of tear gas up ahead. That's where Hanna says the bats are.
Tear gas? Durga must be trying to minimize collateral damage among his people. That explains why the hallways are so empty.
He's inadvertently doing us a favor. Whoever is portraying the voice of Enki is warning about human interference in the affairs of his children.
Well, it wouldn't be a day at the office without someone trying to kill us.
Kane took point, the others falling in step behind him, taking out handkerchiefs to cover their noses and mouths as the chemical sting of tear gas grew stronger. They pulled down their multi-optics to protect their eyes. As it was, Kane could feel the burn in the back of his throat and nose as wisps of the chemical cloud made it through his scarf around the corners of his mouth. It was a hard walk through the terrain, and through the lenses of the multi-optic visor, they could see Naga curled up, clutching chests or heads. Strewed between the stunned cobra folk were neoprene rubber slugs, another less-than-deadly weapon launched from a grenade tube. The ones shot were near clubs and handguns, which they dropped when they were struck by the soft-bodied slugs. With the rib-breaking force of the baton rounds and the lung-burning agony of the tear gas, the Naga were suffering. Hannah stepped ahead of Kane, pointing to an archway.
These are the cobra bats. There are usually guards here.
Kane flexed his wrist and his sin eater slid into his hand.
Keep the cover.
You'll be outnumbered in there.
I'm not going to walk into an ambush. Just the same, keep something solid between you and the enemy guns.
Be careful.
The Naga princess went to the back of the group, and Bridget guided her into an arched doorway with a thick lip. The thick stone would provide her with more than adequate protection from the enemy gunfire. Kane pressed his ear to the chamber door. Though he was tempted to roll in a few non-deadly grenades from his war bag, he held off. The cobra baths were empty, though it was obvious that someone had been in there. Pipes were scattered along the floor, and the coppery dome of an overturned tub was propped in a corner. With the Sin Eater's muzzle leading the way, Kane slipped through the opening.
It's empty, as far as I can tell.
Utility tunnel access?
Kane's sharp eyes were already searching the corners, the ceiling, and the floor for signs of the hatches. None was apparent, but the bath's chamber equipment was in disarray. As it was, he doubted that an army of Naga could stuff themselves into the utility tunnels. His point man's instinct gave the room a clean pass.
Come on in, the place is secure.
Bridget, Domi, and Hannah entered, guns drawn. They took their scarves from their noses and mouths. Bridget looked at the pit in the center of the floor. Kane checked the perimeter of the vaulted room, then glanced at Hannah.
Large place for such a little tub.
The room is sized to accommodate even the largest of families for the transformation from man to cobra. Both for pilgrims making the change, and for observers, especially from the royal family.
They tore it up!
It was to get to this hatch in the middle of the floor, but there appears to be a puzzle-style lock on it.
Kane and Hannah joined Bridget as Domi took over watching the door. The three people looked at the latches. Pictograms adorned the seven locks that secured the hatch to the floor.
These haven't been touched, so Durga didn't go down there. Think you can figure this out?
Bridget knelt, looking at the symbols.
I would presume their reluctance to open the control chamber stemmed from the potential for springing a trap. One misstep and we could unleash doom upon the whole underbelly of this city, or worse.
The patterns look familiar. Perhaps it's one of the passages repeated on the columns?
Absolutely, but which passage? I don't want to misspell the unlocking code, given some of the security measures we've seen in other ancient treasure troves.
The longer we take here, the more likely this area is going to get crowded. We don't just have Durga to worry about, remember?
Kane, we've got company over here. A pair of Nephilim just chased Lakesh and me out of our suite.
Manticore?
Still with us. I wheeled him along.
It'll be difficult getting to the Cobra Baths, Grant. Durga's troops have laid down a lot of tear gas and it's lingering.
I can handle a little cry juice, though Lakesh will end up useless after that. Plus, it wouldn't deter the Nephilim.
It's your prerogative. Personally, I'd rather have Enlil's forces hampered. Grant, what was that?
Looks like when Enlil opened fire on the consortium, he made a few enemies.
Their troops made it in?
The Nephilim and the Millennial shits are exchanging fire. For once, I'm torn as to who's asked to kick first.
Whoever's doing better. Baptiste and I are going to try to find our way to the hidden tunnels beneath the Cobra Baths.
Good luck.
Kane turned back toward the pit and looked at Bridget.
You're going to help, Kane?
Call it a belt and suspenders approach. I get a bad feeling. It'll be my intuition picking up an error in your spelling.
I know that your so-called instinct has a latent psychic aspect, though it's primarily based on your normal, if highly acute, senses. We'd be pushing your limits.
I seem to be picking up strong flashes. Remember that bit before Grant called in?
As much as the skeptic in me wants to say that it was purely coincidence, your intuition has not steered us wrong in the past. However, I will do my best not to get the pattern wrong.
You have an idea?
I'm recalling one of several passages about how Enki crafted the Naga from a sense of love. Correlating that pattern of pictograms with the symbols available for these locks, I might have the code.
Wouldn't that be too obvious?
It might, but given the sequences of pictograms utilizing similar symbology, the same glyphs could construct at least a half a dozen different sentences in the writings on your walls. However, putting it into the context of this particular chamber, which creates all new Naga, I can easily see it being the actual disarmament sequence for the lock.
Let's hope your talent for minutiae will carry us through this.
If not, it's been nice working with you.